give you a brief rundown of the history of the transaction. The originating bank was Red Rock Community Bank, which was an upstart Nevada bank. The borrower was my client, Chris Stumer. The original loan was issued in August of 2000 for $650,000. At that time, there was no guarantees. 2 years later, approximately, there was a change in terms agreement. They increased the underlying line of credit from $650,000 to $1 million. I apologize. Going back to the original loan, there was also 750,000 shares pledged as collateral for the loan, which is important, I think. Going forward to the 2002 novation, they did increase the amount of indebtedness from $650,000 to $1 million. At that time, two family trusts of my clients, not LLCs, mind you, that he's the sole member of, but family trusts executed guarantees with maximum liability clauses.
Were those revocable trusts?
Your Honor, one is irrevocable and the other one is revocable.
Okay, so revocable trust is like you do it individually. It's the same thing.
Well, yeah, the point I was trying to make, though, is it's his brothers, his sisters. It's not, I mean, I think I argued this at the district court level. One of the arguments made was that consent from the borrower inevitably had to flow to the trust because it was all one and the same thing. There was no allegations of any kind of abuse or misuse of the trust formalities in this case, no evidence presented. So, you know, I submitted to the judge, and I will submit to your honors today, that my client, the individual, and the two trusts should have been treated as three separate legal entities. That is why, you know, I brought that point up. So approximately 3 years later, the indebtedness was again increased, this time from $1 million to $1.5 million. Once again, the document required new guarantees to be executed, a new set, so a second set of guarantees were executed by the same guarantors.
Now, that occurred in 2005. There are new guarantees.
Correct, Your Honor. November 2005. Now, a year later, is when I submit that the guarantors were released or exonerated from their obligations.
The guarantee in 2005 said that guarantor's authorization to lender, that guarantor authorizes lender prior to revocation to make one or more additional secured or unsecured loans to borrower. You acknowledge that language, right?
I do acknowledge that language, Your Honor. However, I think that kind of falls into my holder-holder due course position. I don't think that this Michigan entity has the right to assert those waiver defense clauses as a holder in due course would. And I argued that at the lower level, and the district court judge completely dismissed it and made no rulings. I think I put the quote in my brief. I said, Your Honor, you haven't dealt with the holder in due course issue.
But you would say, that if your holder in due course argument fails, does that language control?
I don't think so, Judge. I think there were several different events that would exonerate my clients. If it was just raising the indebtedness, possible. But they didn't just increase the number from 1.5 to 2.2. The collateral vanished from the documents. There was a new, entirely new business loan agreement drafted. That new business loan agreement expressly required new executed guarantees, which were never executed. So I think there's multiple events that would operate to exonerate the guarantors, not just the increase.
So you're saying that they prejudiced subrogation rights against collateral?
Absolutely.
And then the change in verbiage because the new ones required guarantees that weren't executed. Those are your two arguments beyond holder and due course.
I think it was four. The first one was just novation. It was a brand new contract that superseded all prior contracts. I realize what you're saying. The prior contract said it goes on in perpetuity. Well, the new one said we need new guarantees. So I argued in my briefs that trumps the old language. The second argument beyond novation is the express language. The third argument is the increase in the indebtedness. And then the fourth argument is, of course, not only the release of collateral, but the loss of the subrogation rights, as Your Honor just pointed out. So really five different events, if you can stretch the collateral into the subrogation. Because you have the collateral protection, and then, you know, had they not gone after the collateral, as was the right under the guarantee, my clients would certainly have subrogation rights to that collateral.
I didn't mean to interrupt your answer.
Yeah, and on holder in due course issue, if you want to talk about that, I mean, when the bank takes over a failed bank here and through the FDIC or whatever happened, the loans are all assigned to the new bank as part of the acquisition and all like that. So why do they have to be a holder in due course? Why, explain to me that theory. Can the holder assert these
arguments? Well, I'm not contending or contesting, rather, that they're a holder. I understand what you're saying, Your Honor. I'm just saying they're not a holder in due course and why that's right.
It's been a holder under Article 3, but a holder in due course. So I thought a holder in due course was a the completely independent party comes in and pays value.
Pays value, good faith, without notice.
Right. I mean, here, even if they're a holder, I don't understand, if they get, but basically they're getting an assignment. Why can't they assert the guarantee clause?
The primary reason for bringing it up in front of your honors is all of the waiver defense clauses, which they rely upon heavily, go out the window. They can't assert waiver defense clauses.
Well, I get the difference in the holder and due course. Why are you, why aren't, why do...
Oh, why aren't they?
Yeah.
Okay. I was just going to get to that, your honor. So, flash forward from 2000 when the loan originated. Now, it's now traveled to Michigan. The bank is no longer Red Rock Community Bank. Well, they got Las Vegas to roll Red Rock Community Bank via an FDIC takeover, as your honor just pointed out. That bank wasn't acquired by a Michigan company. That Michigan company filed bankruptcy. Obviously, when they filed bankruptcy, all of its assets became subject to the Michigan bankruptcy proceeding. Now, this other Michigan entity came in and acquired four banks. It was the New Mexico Bank. One of the banks was our bank for $4 million.
Now, so they paid money to acquire the banks and their assets.
So the reason why they're not holders in due course, your honor, is they did not take without notice. And I can actually point you directly to a statute. NRS 104-3302-3B specifically states that a person that acquires as part of a bull transaction, not in the regular course of the business of the transferor, is not a holder in due course. So they're by black letter law. And if it, one of the comments
so that you're saying they had notice of the defects in these loans and they took it as probably a big.
They're just
this is a small piece of a big puzzle here, and they took it, and so therefore your client can assert the defenses against them and consider they're in the holder versus holder. Your client.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Okay. They acquired roughly $1 billion worth of assets for $4 million. So they're
well, no, because there were offsetting liabilities against the assets. I mean, that's not a fair statement.
True. However, they were certainly engaged in risky bankruptcy
sure.
profit-sharing
sure,
type of enterprise.
But $1 billion for $4 million is not accurate because there was...
Right.
$4 million less than...
I actually love that you pointed that out, because that's what I wanted to do discovery on at the lower level, and the district court judge wouldn't allow me to do that either. So getting to the 56F concerns you had,
yes.
Your Honor.
Yes, yes.
You know, we made specific requests. As you know, the respondent in this case contends this was a merger, not a pennies on the dollar bankruptcy acquisition, even though the security exchange document says exactly that. I wanted to do discovery into that. I wanted to be able to discover the circumstances surrounding their acquisition. And as I just explained to you guys, it's highly relevant, you know, what their status is and how they acquired these assets, because if they are a holder in due course, then these defenses do come into play. If they're not, then we can assert all of the defenses they contend we waive as a result of these.
Well, if they acquired in a merger, they step into the same shoes as as Red Rock. So that would make them a holder and not a holder in due course, I think. You know,
well,
so
correct.
So tell me how, why that, I guess, we're going around the circle here, but what are the issues you have to delve into in discovery to determine why that makes a difference? You said set off and other defenses you have.
Well, for purposes of summary judgment, I think the motion should have been denied because we produced evidence, specifically a security exchange document as part of the record, that the bank submitted an exchange, not us. So this is their own creation, this document, where they expressly admit, that they purchased these banks, that they acquired these banks as part of an FDIC-approved a bankruptcy purchase. And then what they did was simultaneously merge. It's kind of creative when you think of it. They're trying to sanitize what they did. So when they file all these lawsuits in all these different states where all these different notes, all these borrowers and guarantors live, they can say, no, we stepped into the shoes of the bank, we merged. Well, they absolutely didn't merge, you know, and their own documents acknowledge that. They bought these banks for pennies on the dollar and then subsequently merged the assets together, and they're now saying, hey, we merged. And the point of it being in summary judgment, Your Honor, we submitted that SEC document. That should have been enough in and of itself to create a material issue as to whether or not that occurred. And the district court's analysis, although she never found a merger to have occurred, it's very heavy in merger law and principles. So it's, I think that was fundamentally unfair to my client, because it deprived and denied my clients from a lot of these exoneration defenses we're talking about here today.
Okay.
Counsel, you're at 427.
Okay, would you like to?
I understand your point. Okay, so we'll hear from the other side.
Good morning, Your Honors. Joseph Wendt, appearing on behalf of the respondent, Tama West Bank. This case involves a set of loan documents. It includes business loan agreements. It includes promissory notes. It includes change of terms agreements, commercial guarantees, security agreement, and the forbearance agreement. Mr. Stumer is the borrower under the terms of the note. Mr. Stumer is also the trustee of the guarantor trusts. Now, this loan, it was a revolving line of credit. That means that proceeds are advanced and repaid over the life of the loan.
In June 2000, so it wasn't secured by any real property?
No real property security. And what we see in the briefing is an attempt to morph Chapter 40 principles about consideration paid, about looking first to the collateral, into this loan, which was not secured by real property.
So it had the stock, so it was secured by personal property.
Personal property, so that means the Uniform Commercial Code governs. Now, I would point out for the court that there's no one action rule in the Nevada's Uniform Commercial Code. In June 2012, a forbearance agreement was executed, and I think that's a very important document in the context of this case. In that forbearance agreement, the debtors reaffirmed each of the existing loan documents and their obligation to pay their under. Everything they now complain about, they represented to be true and correct in 2012. In that forbearance agreement, you also find with the waiver of defenses that they now argue here today. I direct the court to AA105, section 5.3 of the forbearance agreement. It contains a provision that states that the recitals and representations in the forbearance agreement constitute binding stipulations of fact. What we see here today is an attempt to walk away from everything they said that was true in 2012. For instance,
which paragraph of the
section 5.3, AA105, section 5.3, state stipulations, the parties agree the recitals, terms, and provisions of this agreement constitute binding stipulations of fact under applicable rules. They want to walk away from that right now today.
But, Mr. Wayne, I think if we look at the 56F issue, they're not walking away. I mean, if we determine the court abuses discretion in not granting the 56F motion, they're just entitled to do some more discovery. Doesn't mean they walk away. I mean, the judge has to rule on it. Merits of the case still.
Well, what we saw in the briefing was an argument that the 2005 guarantees were released and discharged. The forbearance agreement, section 2, states that the 2005 guarantees are operative and in full force and effect. The brief is all about escaping the contractual obligations set forth in those guarantees. Judge Delaney got it right. She correctly ruled on the bank's breach of contract claims. And it's really quite simple. There's a balance owed on this note. And when it came due, Mr. Stumer failed to pay as borrower, and Mr. Stumer failed to pay as guarantor. We heard several arguments here today about why those loan documents should no longer be in full force and effect. I want to highlight the first one that we spent some time discussing here today, and that was this holder in due course concept. What we heard was that the bank is not a holder in due course. It does not get to rely on waiver defenses arising from loan documents. First, I would point out it's correct that the bank is the holder. The bank is the surviving entity after the mergers of its constituent entities that included, in this instance, the originating lender. Second, Mr. Stumer gets the holder in due course argument exactly backwards. The way they argue it, they contend that the holder in due course concepts operate to cut off a lender from raising certain arguments. And in fact, it works the other way around. Holder in due course concepts operate to insulate a holder in due course from certain defenses that a borrower might raise about prior conduct of a prior lender. That's not how they're arguing it here today. So this whole concept of whether the bank is a holder in due course is completely inapplicable.
Well, I think your point is whether the bank is a holder or a holder in due course, it's irrelevant. You have the right to pursue these claims here. Is that correct?
That is correct. This holder in due course concept has no bearing on the outcome of this proceeding, which is we got a loan that was unpaid. Mr. Stumer failed to pay. That's it. There's nothing about holder versus holder in due course that bears in any way on the resolution of these claims. And that's what Judge Delaney was getting right. And that's what she said. I don't have to find the bank as a holder in due course. It's not the holder in due course concepts should protect the lender. They're using it the other way around to try to cut off a lender from waiver defenses. And that's not what holder in due course does. And I would just direct the court to NRS 104.3302, which discusses about how a holder in due course takes free of certain defenses that a borrower might raise. We also heard some waiver arguments with respect to a manumit of collateral. I would point out that personal property collateral, that still exists. It has not been released. It remains encumbered by the bank's lien. And that's set out in AA103.
But they have an offset against the amount due based on the value of the collateral?
If they wanted to liquidate it, present that money to the bank, I think we'd take it. And we heard the relationship to some subrogation elements here. subrogation concepts would apply if these guarantors paid any money at all in connection with this loan. There's no evidence that these borrowers paid any money in connection with this debt that so that was established.
This Congress if they did, they would have whatever rights there are to go against that asset, right?
Absolutely they would. But they haven't paid any money, so what does subrogation have to do with anything here today? No evidence that they paid anything. This collateral is personal property governed by NRS 104. Like I stated previously, there is no one action rule in Nevada's UCC. In fact, NRS 104.9601, that allows a secured party to reduce its claim to judgment before and without exercising its rights to personal property collateral. That also complies with the representations made in the guarantees. The 2005 guarantees set forth in the record at AA73 and AA67, subsection C, contains authorizations that permit the bank to release the collateral without lessening the guarantor's liability. You get AA74 and AA68, certain waivers by the guarantors, and they waived any right. Not that one exists here today, but they waived any right to require the bank to proceed against the collateral. There's no need for discovery on the status of the collateral. Whether it was released or not is irrelevant to the amount owed by these debtors. The guarantees specifically permit every action that was taken by the bank in this case.
On the 56F motion, what was the date the motion for summary judgment was filed, and when was the 56F opposition filed?
So the date that the motion for summary judgment was filed was in 2014, and we saw in the opposition that was ultimately filed the 56F request. And I'd have to look at the briefs to specify that date. I do know that the motion was filed in 2014. I do know that it was continued several times while the parties discussed. I would also point out that we did submit written discovery. We propounded written discovery on the debtors in this instance. That went unanswered. The assumption was from our side that they simply agreed that these documents were the controlling documents. There was no need to conduct any further discovery. We saw that every time this concept
walk us through, because I think the court is interested in understanding why it was not an abuse of discretion to turn down the 56F request.
Okay, so what were the items that discovery was sought on?
Yeah.
Was it in connection with the status of the collateral? I think we discussed that the personal property collateral's disposition has no bearing on this case. Second item, the status of the acquisition of the underlying bank shares, the constituent entities?
No consequence. Yeah.
What does that have to do with
that's
anything?
That's your point, yeah.
The document that they like to point to, and that's this SEC filing set forth in the record at AA178-179, uses the exact terms here, which is merger terms. That what happened was a third party bought bank shares, equity. The owners of the bank changed. This wasn't a sale of a loan portfolio by a lender to some third party. This was the acquisition of underlying bank shares. And that they were subsequently merged up into the surviving entity. And those merger documents are all on the record as well. They're contained within the Nevada Secretary of State's records, publicly available, disclosed in the...
So are those the three areas they identified as needing discovery on?
I see only two, the status of the personal property collateral and the status of the acquisition of the bank shares.
Okay.
And neither of those concepts, I think, have any bearing on what these debtors owe. And it comes back to the simple point, which Judge Delaney was getting right, which is there's an unpaid loan. These borrowers failed to pay. That's it. And so it's really quite simple. You saw some challenges to the establishment of the bank's breach of contract claim. They challenged each element. They challenged the breach. The breach is simple. There's a balance that's due and owing. The sum that the bank paid for the shares of its constituent entities has no relevance to what these debtors owe on this particular loan. This isn't a Chapter 40 case. You know, prior we had these arguments about consideration paid. There's no real property security here. It has nothing to do with what these debtors owe. You saw a challenge to causation, and the argument in the brief seems to be that the bank damaged itself by getting involved with what they term to be risky bankruptcies, speculative profiteering. That's not the causation that forms the underpinning of this breach of contract claim. The borrowers failed to pay under the terms of the loan documents. That's the causation that underpins the bank's breach of contract claim. The bank's damages are quantified by the unpaid loan amount. So there's really nothing that discovery could provide that would challenge the establishment of those elements. We heard an argument here today about the waiver of the guarantees were somehow discharged by the increase in the indebtedness. The waiver language from the 2005 guarantees is effective as represented in the 2012 forbearance agreement. The allegation that the
He says, though, that the later increase from 1.5 to 2.2, because it made reference to new guarantee agreements, was an ovation. And could you answer that?
Yes, I can. A couple of points. This argument about the material alteration in the underlying loan seems to be that Chris Doomer, as borrower, he agreed to the increase in the available loan proceeds, but that Chris Doomer, as trustee of the guarantor trust, did not agree to that increase and somehow didn't know about the increase in available loan proceeds. Well-established suretyship principles confirm that Mr. Stumer's knowledge of bank consent as borrower equates to a consent as guarantor and defeats his arguments that the guarantees were released. This novation concept, they point to a particular document, and that's the second change in terms agreement that was executed in 2002 that resulted in an increase in the credit line and extended the maturity date. In order to find a novation, this court has consistently ruled that the intent of the parties to cause a novation must be clear. And in determining intent, the courts look to the parties' manifest intent as in their documents, not subjective intent. There's a particular clause in the subject document, AA32. It contains a continuing validity provision. This clause demonstrates that the parties required that the original loan documents remain unchanged and in full force and effect, except as modified by the change in terms agreement, which again was to increase the credit line and to extend the maturity date. As the change in terms agreement, and especially the continuing validity clause, AA32, continuing validity, includes nothing regarding the relieving of prior incurred obligations, this court should conclude that that loan document does not demonstrate the required intent for a novation. That's why this novation argument should fail. You saw in the brief an argument that the bank should not have prevailed on its breach of contract claims because of an alleged failure to mitigate its damages. And this whole concept seems to be that Talmer's involvement with bad loans is a per se violation of its duty to mitigate. That's just a nonsensical argument. There's a fixed sum that is owed. There's no way to alter or reduce what has not been paid. There's nothing to mitigate. Once the default occurred, the bank had the option to sue to enforce the note. That's exactly what occurred. You heard some reference to the bank's conduct as risky. And I think another way to state this argument is that the bank should have known better that when Mr. Stumer promised to pay under the loan documents, that he would do so, that he would not live up to his contractual obligations. That's what the argument seems to be. That this was all risky and speculative. We should have known that when he said he'd pay, that he wouldn't. The bank fully expects Mr. Stumer to pay, and so there's no speculative profiteering going on here. This is simply trying to enforce rights that we have under the contracts. Based on that, Your Honor, Judge Delaney got it correct. She correctly ruled on the breach of contract claims. And with that, we submit that this court should affirm Judge Delaney's decision.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Hayes, as you approach, what I'm primarily interested in, again, is pretend I'm Judge Delaney. Give me bullet points on your 56F issues and what you need more time to delve into, because your opposing counsel has said you don't need any more time. These are all legal issues and you lose. So tell me your
well, first off, there was more grounds submitted in the affidavit required by 56F for than just the collateral. But again, going back to this issue, the bank just admitted this is a UCC case out of one side of his mouth, and then out of the other says holder new course just simply doesn't apply. It absolutely applies. And we don't have it backwards, and I'll give you guys a case. Peterson v. Royland Enterprises, the site is 529 F sub 584. It's a federal district of Nevada case interpreting the Nevada statutes on it. And it unequivocally operates the way that the borrower was protected in this case, the guarantors. We are applying it correctly. I don't have the incorrect operation of that doctrine in this case, and that's significant. And that was one of the primary issues, Your Honor, to get back to your question, that we sought 56F relief for, because this is not, I mean, you heard time and time again about how Mr. Stumer doesn't pay his bills, about how the guarantors didn't pay anything, about how subrogation won't trigger. They didn't pay anything. They're not Red Rock Community Bank. They're not even Bank of Las Vegas. They're not even Talmer Bank anymore. They're now a new bank, Chemical Bank. And the reason why that's relevant, that's why that transaction is so relevant, is this was not a scenario where a bank failed and the FDIC came in to protect all the assets, marshal it out, and then get some other bank to come in. Everyone knows why that's good. It's good for the economy. You don't want to have all that squandered.
Okay, so you have the holder in due course issue you wish to pursue right. further. What else?
On several levels, though, not just on that level. As I just mentioned, this note's been transferred, retransferred, retransferred. I wanted to do discovery into the circumstances surrounding Christopher's underlying loan with Red Rock Community Bank. We submitted a lot of testimony. The bank came to him. This bank wasn't in existence. You know, he came to Mr. Stuner. Mr. Stuner was a problem.
How does that affect the liability issue?
Well, I wanted to do some research and consult with some experts and see if I could put some valuation on that. He came to the bank, brought the bank recognition. He was Christopher Holmes LLC. He's a very reputable local builder. He had his friends and his business colleagues do business with this bank. They came to him and said, come sit on our board, buy some of our products, borrow some of our money, talk to some of your friends and colleagues about us.
In writing indicated they were giving him a special position because of this relationship you're talking about?
Beyond my client's affidavit, Your Honor, no. Just his testimony and his affidavit.
Because what the record seems to indicate is, counsel put forth, no payments were made.
Well, the line of credit was paid up and down numerous times. Correct, there's money owed ultimately, Your Honor. And we acknowledge that, you know. But what I'm here arguing, you know, beyond the 56F issue is, someone's going to get a windfall, Your Honors. And, you know, either my client's not going to have to pay some money that was owed. I think the guarantors were exonerated. I don't think you guys want to hear more about that.
Coming back to the 56F, which is kind of the linchpin of where we're at today, and the summary judgment. You've talked about this Red Rock Bank. You've talked about Holder in due course. Anything else you want us to look at?
With respect to 56F, yeah, just the multiple transactions, Your Honor, but I think you hit the nail on the head. There's every time this asset was transferred, you know, I think we have a right to know the nature of that transaction.
But I think counsel's saying this is all by mergers, then, so.
That's absolutely not correct, though, Your Honor, and we've submitted evidence refuting that that should have been viewed in the light most favorable to us.
Okay,
and
so you're saying.
I'm sorry, we're going to run out of time here, but when I looked at these, my timeline of this is the lawsuit was filed in February of 2013, correct?
That sounds correct.
When was it filed?
That sounds accurate. I just don't want to. That sounds to be perfect.
Well, the motion for summary judgment was filed in August of 2014.
Yeah, I actually wanted to address that because you brought that up.
And the opposition was filed in April of 2015, which is, I don't know, 8 months later?
Well, that was per agreement with counsel. We were.
But there was no discovery taken in that whole time period. Right?
We were deliberately not doing discovery. We were engaged in settlement negotiations, global settlement negotiations, not just this case. There's actually a separate lawsuit
okay.
still. So that's why, I mean, the bank just painted a picture of us essentially being dilatory. I want to point out.
No, it's an abuse of discretion standard, though, for the district court to manage its docket. And when you come with a 56F affidavit, you have to explain what was going on.
Correct. And I did. And she was satisfied with that. Her ruling wasn't, Mr. Hayes, you dropped the ball. The ruling was, I don't see anything here for you to discover.
Okay, fair enough.
Because throughout this process, and the reason we didn't answer discovery was to save on costs while we were discussing some. They never filed a motion to compel. It wasn't a scenario like that where we weren't participating in discovery.
Okay.
With that, counsel, your time is up.
Thank you for that. That's
thank you.
Argument. Counsel, thank you for the
thank you, Your Honor.
Enlightening arguments this morning. This matter will stand submitted. We are in recess till 11:30.